This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Stephanie Stein-Kreese. She is a jazz historian, author, editor, and former senior jazz coordinator for the jazz arts program, Manhattan School of Music. And we're talking about her latest book, Rhythm Man, Chick Webb, and the Beat That Changed America. Stephanie, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, I'm really grateful to talk to you, and it's a pleasure to be back on your station in Worcester, Massachusetts, which I've passed by many times.
Yeah, that's usually the story. Everybody drives through us on their way to north. Yeah. Stephanie, what brought you?
It's a wonderful thing. Go ahead.
I've been here a long time. What brought you to write this biography? This must have been a difficult book to research.
It was an incredibly difficult book to research, and other writers, you know, it's kind of like I kind of skirted around the edges, knowing that I was interested in doing it. I've been, you know, kind of jazz historian, jazz writer, jazz journalist, administrator of a jazz program at a music conservatory. You know, I've been in the music industry on and off years ago in the record industry. So it's sort of, I've had various periods where I was really deep into the swing era or deep into swing era projects, not books, you know, and then other times, you know, more interested in, you know, more contemporary jazz, modern jazz, but also, I'll put it honestly, I'm an omnivore music person. I listen to all kinds of stuff. But I've been, you know, kind of skirting with the idea of writing about Chick Webb, who, you know, there's other people had written about him, small book about him, but no one had written like a full-scale biography. And I really kind of had to do some pre-research just to make sure there was kind of enough there.
Yeah.
He died young,
but the thing that's great about this book is not only is it his biography, but there's so much that you've also written about the milieu. For instance, the Savoy Ballroom. The more I read about it, the more I wanted to read an entire book just about the Savoy Ballroom.
Yeah, the Savoy is it's an incredible history. You know, it's like,
well, what I read about it in your book was outstanding.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's fascinating. And, you know, part of this is I grew up in New York. You know, my father was a big jazz fan, which is a lot of what led me into jazz. And he was an avid dancer. You know, so he was one of those kids during the Depression, you know, that the Savoy had some of the best musicians in town. That was, you know, kind of when the ballroom really, I think I really detailed this in the book, even though, you know, it's sort of totally known as one of the first integrated ballrooms, dance palace, you know, kind of what you would think of as a dance palace
today,
a mosh pit.
Well, as you wrote in your book, people came there to dance.
Right.
And people were serious. The people who came there were serious music lovers.
And serious dancers.
Yeah.
Hoppers.
Well, I want to talk about Chick Webb. Do you feel like he's not gotten the recognition he deserves?
Well, it's almost like a cultural memory thing where he died so young.
Right.
And even though he was so influential, you know, it's sort of, he's sort of gotten passed over in recent decades. Just, you know, it's like, oh, that was that guy, you know? and so in some ways he's certainly in major jazz reference works like, you know, Gunther Schuller's Swing Era and,
but in our cultural memory, it's sort of the wider cultural memory he's been left out.
Yeah.
Well, and what's incredible is you talk to any serious drummers that came after him and he was the epitome. He was incredibly well known. He was called the King of Drums, the King of the Savoy Ballroom. I mean, he had all these names that people called him, that which really contributed to him. Let's talk about his early childhood. He was born in East Baltimore, 1905. Now, I think one of the incredible things for me is we would call him, he was disabled, not disabled, he was physically challenged because of, of a childhood illness.
Right. He had spinal tuberculosis as a child, which is, a kind of different form of tuberculosis. Yeah. He might have had the more common bacteria first, but it went to his chin. Children really does, it kind of totally impairs their growth, physical height, and so forth because of the spinal, it just compresses areas of the spine. So he also developed a hunchback, he had a lot of challenges as a child, and I was unfortunately not able, it's very hard to get medical records from way back then, and or if they, got lost in the shuffle. So that was one of the hardest things that I couldn't really get a hold of, but I sort of got a, was able to at least get a better grip on what this disease did to him. And then that impaired him, the chronic effects of the disease. It's like he probably went through periods where he was kind of fine, and very active as a drummer, as you can imagine, running around both Baltimore and New York, being on the scene, but in a certain way, his other, other parts of his body got very compromised as he got more and more famous. So it's just this heartbreaking story of how, the more famous he got, the more it compromised his health. So, and he, but it's like he was just one of those people. It's like he was riding the top of his game by the time he died. And he just, I did read some accounts where he was thinking of stopping back, and, his colleagues had asked him to stop back, his manager asked him to step back, and he might have tried, but it's just like, no.
Reading your book, I get the image that he had too much energy.
Yeah.
When people describe him playing drums, I mean, he sat up there in the center and sort of, as a lot of people described it, like the throne in the middle of the orchestra. And man, he just wailed.
Yeah, but it's also like he was, I want to say, he was really ambitious.
Oh, yeah.
As a band leader and as a musician, it was really, we have to think of it, it's like, he wanted to be in the echelon of, the top bands working at the time. And he was, but it took a lot of doing, and it took a lot of, it's like you wouldn't even call it jazz. It was really the pop music. What he and Ella Fitzgerald band were doing, it was great jazz, jazz-oriented music, but we could consider it the pop music of its time, So they were stars. They were national stars. And, I just kind of feel like I couldn't get over how it's like he died doing what he got his dream. He got his dream for himself, the band, and for Ella. They were hit. They were on the radio. They were traveling all over the place, So it's like more power to him. It's like I still feel like hats off to Chick Webb.
Absolutely.
Plus,
absolutely.
It's also like his mastery of the drums wasn't, just kind of as a killer drummer, but it's as a really musical drummer.
Yeah,
so I think that's where the influence comes in. It's like if you listen to, it's almost like he drummed the whole arrangement. So in that sense, he was really influential as a, the guys, who became major beboppers, like Max Roach came to listen to him all the time. He influenced Art Blakey as a young drummer, Kenny Clarke, that whole next generation of drummers who got to hear him were like,
And he was self-taught on drums.
I kind of always feel like self-taught, he started playing with other people as a young drummer in Baltimore and young, in kind of probably what we're talking still, what it wasn't even called jazz then, but ragtime-oriented dance band.
Right.
And Baltimore had a very, very high-quality pool of musicians, black musicians, a very rich, diverse black musical scene. And that was one of the real joys of doing the research of stuff that I just didn't know, really. You know, it's like we think of New Orleans, we think of Chicago, we think of New York, you know, we think the L.A. scene in a different way. But it's like, you know, Baltimore is kind of one of the overlooked nexuses of fabulous jazz history, you know, starting with the great ragtime pianist, UB Blake, and other people we've never heard of, Billie Holiday, and the Calloways, you know, so it's kind of
There's a big but, Stephanie. There was a tremendous migration of those, all that talent to New York.
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. You know, so it's kind of like you almost have to think about, well, the people who stayed put, you know, they also had, you know, their own very vital scene. Yep. But the ones who really wanted to make it big, which included Chick Webb, went to New York, you know, and same with D.C., you know, Duke Ellington kind of preceded him. So I had a lot of, I really had fun, you know, kind of digging into that part.
One of the things I love about your book is he gets to New York, he gets to Harlem. What do you do as a musician? Just show up? And you have tremendous details in your book about the kinds of things a new musician would do at that time. Thanks. Like there were these legendary jam sessions.
Right. Right.
And I like the fact you even talk about rent parties.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was all part of the scene, you know, and in Harlem, it was just like that was such a rich and dynamic scene. And I read, you know, just so many accounts by different people. One of my favorite books was Rex Stewart's memoir, Boy with a Horn. Rex Stewart was a trumpet player, African-American trumpet player who, you know, became famous with Duke. But he was just so much fun to read about what it felt like to be a young musician in Harlem in the, you know, in the 20s. You know, again, which is kind of, you know, not the flowering of jazz in New York City and in Harlem, and just like that they would go roller skating down Lenox Avenue. You know, it's like they were young. They were having a great time. They stayed up all night. But this little nexus of clubs, you know, so I went up to the neighborhood. I still, you know, I live in New York up on the Upper West Side, but researching the book, I just kind of would go crawling around the neighborhood because there's this nexus of blocks that they talked about where it's like, oh, this one was over here, this one was over there. You know, these little basement speakeasies in these brownstone buildings, many of which are still there. And it's just kind of, I just felt like for this book, I did a lot of mental time traveling.
Nice, nice.
Backed up with a lot of research.
Well, I wanted to see the Savoy Ballroom. I mean, it opened its doors in 1926. It was intended and built for black audiences. And the management was Charles Buchanan?
Well, he was the first manager, and he was the manager for decades until the ballroom closed. And he, I think at a certain point, was also, a part owner. And then I'm not quite sure how the ownership thing worked by the time that he was really running the ballroom. Mo Gale had kind of gone on to other things after World War II. So I don't know how the financial interests worked after Mo started doing other things. But he was it, you know, and he did kind of a brilliant job.
Oh, man.
You know, kind of getting things going. But so did Mo Gale, and the Galuski family really deserve a lot of credit for doing what they did, because once people caught on to it, and it became much more of an integrated scene during the 30s, especially starting in the mid-30s when swing was like, swing was it, you know, swing music as played by big bands, you know, but it was a landmark, you know, so it was like Coney Island. You wouldn't come to New York without going to the Savoy Ballroom.
That's right.
You know, it's just like one of the things you did. So, but it was also, I always like to, you know, let people realize it wasn't just the home, because it was called the home of happy feet, you know, for the Lindy Hoppers. But it was also, you know, kind of a place in the community that, where during the Depression, you know, they held benefits,
almost weekly,
you know, for like unemployment relief, you know, causes for kids, fundraisers for unemployed musicians, you know, just fundraisers for the Scottsboro Boys Defense Fund.
It was amazing. So, they were a major community resource.
Right. Absolutely. And Buchanan was very much behind that.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Stephanie Stein-Kreese. She's a jazz historian, author, editor, and former senior jazz coordinator for the jazz arts program, Manhattan School of Music. And we've been talking about her latest book. It is a stunning biography, Rhythm Man, Chick Webb, and the Beat That Changed America. He finally gets a really good band together, the Harlem Stompers. I think it was February 1927. And they were playing the Savoy Ballroom at the time. Now, talk to me about the Lindy Hop, because the Lindy Hop becomes really, really important.
Right, absolutely. The Lindy Hop, you know, was sort of, you know, there are other people who are far more experienced and authoritative dance scholars, but it's sort of the Lindy Hop started really taking off. It was kind of funnily named for Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic solo flight, you know, and then I've heard it. I actually saw in a few newspaper clippings from the time that it was, you know, people referring it to the Lindbergh Hop, you know, and then it got transmorphed into the Lindy Hop, you know, so it's like people were doing the Lindy Hop at the Savoy Ballroom in the early 30s, but it was sort of like, you know, not everyone was into it yet, and it didn't become the kind of exhibition type dance until some of the Savoy regulars really got into it and were kind of assisted by a guy who wanted to professionalize these really young dancers, Whitey's Lindy Hoppers. And that's what really started putting it on the map. And one of those dancers, legendary dancer Frankie Manning, sort of choreographed these very athletic but still total dance in motion, and, you know, aerial steps where people would be throwing each other around. And you can see a lot of this footage on YouTube and various dance sites. It's just like, it's unbelievable, you know, because they're like Olympic athletes, you know, but it's dance. And but not everybody did that, you know. Most people had their feet on the ground, but they became, it really gave, I think it also popularized what was going on at the Savoy.
Yeah,
you know.
Now
so,
we're going to run out of time here, Stephanie.
Okay,
I have like pages of stuff I wanted to talk to you about, but I'm going to have to mention the story of Ella Fitzgerald and how she finally made it to his band. But her career was launched at an amateur night.
Yep.
And what a story is that in your book. I mean, she wanted to dance.
Yeah. And that was, you know, that's again, it's an apocryphal story. So what really happened, everybody thinks, oh, Chick hired her overnight or she was a star overnight. She won the talent contest as an unknown teenager. You know, she was going to dance, but then she got literally cold feet and sang. And other people heard her, though. So it took a little while for Chick to finally hear her. But because she then also kept doing it, you know, that she was like him, just persistent, didn't give up, entered other talent contests, got a bit of, you know, and musicians on the scene in Harlem, it's like they'd go to everything else. They'd go check out everyone else. So it was finally a couple of people in Chick's band heard her at a different situation where she was allowed to sing for a week with another kind of named band. And they, you know, they came back and kept saying, Chick, you got to hear this girl. You got to hear her. She's got something special. And it was just the young, buoyant thing where she could sing with a swing band in a way that, you know, was still a little, not everybody was doing that. And it just ended up one of those collaborations that I think is just so unusual, but so fabulous in the musical world, where it's like what she developed as a young singer, as she was still developing, just fit the music that Chick's band was playing, which was big band swing at that time. And, you know, it's really kind of, boy, they were all so lucky.
It was like a marriage made in heaven. I mean, it was perfect.
Yes.
Fit. A perfect.
Yes.
Fit.
Yes.
Now, he
yes.
also, Chick also earlier played with Louis Armstrong.
That was one of the magical things also. You know, it's sort of, I'd heard about it, but I hadn't really researched it. You know, so that is, I devoted, you know, a good chunk of a chapter to how, and that's before Chick's band became really famous on its own. He was still just kind of a struggling band leader. And Louis came back from Europe and needed a band. You know, so one of his managers said, hey, you could just use Chick Webb's band. You know, so they recorded and toured together for, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks in the winter of 1932, going into 33, I think. But it was like Louis Armstrong's debut recordings with RCA Records, which was a really big deal at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
So Louis was already a big deal, but it's like, it's a fascinating thing. And I guess the other thing I came away with, like, Chick intersected with every important musician on the scene in his career. And it's just, there are a lot of, I think I find a lot of stories, but it's like, it's just, I guess it's just like, I love the idea of like all these people intermingling.
I know, isn't it?
In New York.
In a section, in a small section of New York too. And they all, now the thing is, everybody raided everybody else's band too. And Chick Webb was like, if somebody needed a musician, he would actually tell the musician in his band, you know. I mean, he was like losing musicians left and right.
Yes, yes. Well, not exactly left and right, but there was a period where I think I made a note of one of them that was a really famous raid. And again, this was early on. So one of his best trombonists and lead saxophone players got traded with Fletcher Henderson.
Yep.
But it's like they both came out beautifully, you know, sir. And Russell Prokope, who was this wonderful alto saxophonist, who was, again, very prominent with Duke later on, was like, he said it was just kind of a wild thing. One night, you know, we just switched stands. And no one knew, you know, it's like it was seamless. but I'm not, you know, honestly, at the moment, I can't quite remember what was the reasoning behind it. I'd have to go back to my book.
Well, part, you know, we only have a few minutes left too, and I want to, but there are lots that you write about how these musicians survived the Depression. And that was an amazing story. I mean, they did everything possible to make a living during one of the darker moments in the 20th century. But in the end, a lot of the clubs closed.
Yes, absolutely. But the ballroom, you know, stayed open. You know, they didn't make money.
But they had to do everything. Didn't they have to show films at some point?
I don't know.
That was another club that had to show films.
I think that was different. That was the theaters, you know, but the Savoy didn't. But it's like, that's where I kind of feel like it really shined as a community thing, because they'd, you know, people could go there for a dime, or every night of the week, it was like ladies' night or this night or that night, you know, so it just managed to really, I think, through flexibility and strategy and keeping, you know, shifting gears a lot. Mo, I think part of what he did as a businessman, Mo Gale, the owner, which was so savvy, was he was able to get some of these bands on the radio, and that made a huge difference. Really made a big difference for Chick.
Yeah, it did.
He was actually kind of really big on the radio before Ella entered the band, just that year. You know, so stuff stuff kind of worked out in ways that in hindsight we're like, wow, that's pretty amazing. And but I just also am in awe of the way, you know, some of these bands worked all the way through the Depression. You know, they did, you know, and some of them actually did really well. So that was like a plummy job, even if you think the salary, the union salary at the Savoy was pathetic, but you could live on that, you know. So, the persistence of like, keep all these people together, 15, 16.
I found it amazing. I found it absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, so, man.
Me too.
Now, we just have one more minute left. When did Chick die?
Okay. He died in 1939, June 16th, 1939. And at that point, as I mentioned, the band was absolutely at the height of its popularity.
Yeah, yeah,
they were, and in the midst of an East Coast tour that was heading south. And at that point, the band actually carried a wonderful drummer, you know, as
we're going to have to stop there. We are completely out of time. And like I said, I had pages more to talk about. My guest tonight has been Stephanie Stein-Kreese. She's a jazz historian, which I'm sure you can realize, author, editor, and former senior jazz coordinator for the jazz arts program, Manhattan School of Music. And we've been talking about her dynamic latest book, Rhythm Man, Chick Webb and the Beat That Changed America. This is one of those books that you'll come away with a real feeling of what it was like to be a musician at that time period. Stephanie, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. And as other writers, sorry if I digress, but it was a pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.